at the time of this recording, a lot of tech companies, multiples are compressed, and especially SaaS company multiples are compressed. And I think the reason for that is everybody is wondering, like, what is the moat? And in an era where we might reasonably see, like, an information worker, like, totally built and operated by a company like Anthropic, what does that do to per seat pricing? And now that might sound like far-fetched, that we might actually have like a synthetic human, but I actually don't think it's that far off.
This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action, with host Armon Shrocki. Each week, Armon will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curve.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. This episode, we have a guest and with a very great story. I like this story when he told me. I think it was unique in a way. And he's based in Boston nowadays. We know this winter was a little bit with a lot of snow. Even in Austin, we had a white kind of, Austin this year, so exceptionally cold. But also it's a very special time. We are going to talk about topics that is relevant with software industry and SaaS industry at this very special time. And I'm so glad to say, Pete Hunt is joining us, and we are going to cover a number of these topics. So Pete, welcome to the show, and please tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the company before we start talking about these fantastic topics.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm Pete. I'm the CEO here at Dagster Labs. We build the data ops platform from the future. What that actually means concretely is we have an open source project called Dagster, which is the foundation of your data platform. It's in a category called orchestration. And then we have a commercial product that sits on top of that, that adds all of the different capabilities that you need to build an amazing AI-ready data platform for 2026. So build data pipelines, operate those data pipelines, manage them with agents, et cetera. And then recently last year, we've kind of expanded into the generative BI category. And we now have a product called Compass that takes advantage of that whole platform and brings data from your data warehouse right to your business stakeholder directly, right where they already work in Slack, MS Teams, and other applications that they're already in. So been a very exciting past couple of years. I originally came from a technical background, was an engineer for a long time. And then I been in dev tools and open source for a long time. And then I joined here as head of engineering, lied, cheated, and stole my way to the top and became CEO by the end of my first year. And my good friend and founder took the fun job, which was CTO. So I think everybody's happy in that relationship.
Fantastic. As we briefly talked about it before, this interview, this is a special time. I mean, for the first time, many people in software industry asking themselves, do I have the right go-to-market strategy? Is it going to be the same? Maybe software is changing forever. Maybe writing code is not really that kind of high value, proposition anymore. And maybe we should think about really AI models and some other things. Can you share with us your thought on where we are, especially when it comes to data analytics and everything else at the age of AI? Is it going to change drastically in your view? is the go-to-market strategy of software companies has to change very quickly to stay relevant. And, you know, let's start from there.
Yeah, and I think the answer is yes to almost every question that you just asked there. I mean, at the time of this recording, a lot of tech companies, you know, multiples are compressed, and especially SaaS company multiples are compressed. And I think the reason for that is everybody is wondering, like, what is the moat? And in an era where we might reasonably see like an information worker, like totally built and operated by a company like Anthropic, what does that do to per seat pricing? And now that might sound like far-fetched that we might actually have like a synthetic human, but I actually don't think it's that far off. You know, again, yesterday Sonnet 4.6 launched, right? And where did we see the biggest improvement in benchmarks in that model? It was in a thing called computer use, right? Which is moving the mouse, typing on the keyboard, using an arbitrary web app or native application on your computer, using one of the cheaper models from Anthropic. And we've set up a world, you know, largely due to the pandemic 5 years ago, 6 years ago, which is much more remote worker friendly than it's ever been. And so you can very easily see like, okay, we take Claude code, we glue it to, where we integrate it with Notion MCP to get all the onboarding docs for an employee. We give it a Zoom integration and a web browser and, you know, a Microsoft OneDrive and Office 365 account or Google or G Suite or whatever. And like, it's going to be able to do a lot of stuff, right? And so I think that in an era where that could happen, in an era where human software engineers are writing code, you know, five times as fast at least right now, what are the moats in SaaS? And then you're seeing that, you know, the multiples on revenue really crater this year. Now, I'm not a public markets guy. I have no idea whether these companies are priced appropriately or not. But what I do know is that they are going to have to adapt to this new environment. The innovator's dilemma is super real. And the organizational momentum that the leadership teams of these companies are going to have to overcome is going to be super hard. With that said, the companies and the employees and the leadership teams, the boards of these companies are the best that have ever been in the game. They've all read The Innovator's Dilemma and Lean Startup. They all know the situation they're in. Just the question is going to be, can they figure a way out and execute?
Fantastic. And, you know, many people expect that software in general will change. And probably, you know, you have heard Elon Musk in one interview even claiming that, you know, the only thing you need is just you need to talk and then get the response. Why do you need even keyboard anymore, right? So so there are very drastic ideas like that that may happen, but the question is when? How long does it take to really get there? And from your perspective, let's say, you know, we are at the age today that, you know, you talked about data and data needs to be a quality data in order for AI to work. Mm-hmm. Are we there yet for companies to really go to AI route and get a boost on the quality of the data or solve the data problems that they have? Because those are the toughest problems exist. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about analytics for most of the time, people wrongfully may think that, hey, we are talking about just some nice charts we put there and that's it. I'm talking about the dashboard. But really, in order for analytics to work, they need to have really a robust foundation of the data. And that's 90% of the time and money needs to go before you get to the easy part that I need to set up some, you know, visualizations or make it even autonomous with AI and AI agents and, you know, those kind of things. That seems to be the easiest part. But how do you feel about that? That where we are going with a near future in the next year or two with regard to really solving those data problems for organizations?
Well, the good news is, by some definition of good news, we as an industry have really solved a lot of data problems over the last 10 years. I mean, if you rewind the clock 10 years, you know, I think that was like the Hadoop era probably, right? And, you know, we could barely compute over large data sets, right? And today, enterprises have, for the most part, gotten all their data into a cloud data warehouse or a data lake or a lake house or however you want to brand it. There are multiple query engines that all work really well that can query that data, you know, mostly using some sort of SQL dialect and integrating with a bunch of different services. We have really great connectors into SaaS products as well. So if you've got data in your CRM and you want to join it to your call recording transcripts, you know, that's very easy to do now. And so in many ways, we've like set up this great environment for AI to thrive in the enterprise. And if you think about like, why have there been failed AI deployments in the enterprise? I mean, that was a very big topic maybe like a year ago, was, you know, everybody bought all this AI stuff and it didn't work. And it didn't create value for the customer. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the models are getting better like every 3 to 6 months. Like Opus 4.5, I think it was December of last year, it was like a big deal for software engineers, right? Like that was the first model where it was like, wow, this thing is as good of a software engineer as me as a human. And it's way faster than me as a human. So first of all, the models are way better now than they've ever been. And second, I think that enterprises, you know, in many ways, AI kind of changes everything. It drops the value of software dramatically. It changes go-to-market motions. We might have virtual information workers, and that might change a lot of things too. But in other ways, like everything is still the same, right? Like the biggest barrier to AI adoption, like the AI labs will like call it like diffusion, which is like a very like fancy word. But what that means is just like what we've known in SaaS for a million years, right? Which is like habit formation, behavior change, selling, customer success post-sale, driving that business process change that's necessary to take advantage of any new technology. It's the exact same with AI. And so I think that was the problem with a lot of these AI deployments before, is like nobody knew how to do that. We have a point of view that data is a really great place to start with that. And a lot of enterprise AI deployments get blocked and slowed down by the inability to connect to enterprise data, the inability to understand that enterprise data without a really painful onboarding process. And then again, habit formation, behavior change, taking that data, taking that those AI insights or activation of that data and putting it into the daily driver of a human's, you know, work day. Because at the end of the day, like AI models haven't replaced all of us yet. You still have to make a human successful in order for your product to be successful.
So maybe it's a relevant question, but it is not exactly related to what you just said. But I wanted to take some points from that and connect it to what you said. Let's say somebody might be, you know, your son or daughter, it might be your cousin, comes to you and say, hey, I'm at the time that I need to pick, you know, what should I study in a school, in university, I'm going there, and should I really go and just study computer science anymore and, you know, understand how to write code and these kind of things? Or if not, what do you, you know, recommend me to study? What would you say?
Yeah, fortunately, my kids are 4 and 1, so I've got a little bit of time for this to shake out. But, you know, it's a hard question. I think right now it's still, you know, I think computer science is okay, but not for the reasons why a lot of people think. So, you know, I think a lot of people see AI as a force multiplier for engineers. And that is definitely true today. And I think that's going to remain true for another year or two because of this like diffusion and behavior change problem, right? Like, and because a lot of companies have been so talent constrained for so long that 5x-ing, 10x-ing their engineering productivity is just like right-sizing the team for the problem in the market that they're tackling. But I do think that that hits a wall at some point, and I think it's probably a year or two away, but it's kind of hard to really know. I'm just thinking that, you know, Opus 4-5 was the starting gun for something that could actually replace a human, and then it probably takes a year or two from there to have let the market figure that out and deploy it and understand how to deploy it, right? But I think that that bodes really well for a software engineer like today, and like pretty bad for a software engineer 2 years from now. But what I also think is that a lot of disciplines are going to look a lot more like engineering. So, you know, software engineers, they're not going to write code anymore. They're still going to have to understand systems. They're still going to have to understand what's going on under the hood to debug and optimize these systems. I think that the software engine, like, somebody's going to have to be accountable for the output of the AI system, right? I think that that is just a permanent thing. Like, if an AI is doing something, somebody's going to get promoted if it does well, and somebody's going to get fired if it ruins the business, right? And so, I think software engineers are going to be, that skill set is going to be among the most valuable and useful for doing that. And so you're going to see, and you're seeing it already a little bit now, like software engineers running marketing, for example, right? Like, marketing is going to become, in my opinion, a pure science, a pure, software and AI driven and engineering driven process. And revenue science is going to be most strongly deployed within marketing. I think sales, I think sales is among like outside sales is like among the most durable job functions in the AI era. I think that humans will always be the one making the final capital allocation decision, and they want another human on the other end of that deal, like reassuring them and educating them on it. I also think that part of that sales team, as a lot of SaaS founders know, like, the forward deployed engineer, the sales engineer, is among the most valuable people on that go to market team, and the people with CS degrees in that function kick ass and do really, really well in those roles. So that's why I think that a CS degree is probably like probably a pretty good bet right now. But I would also just say that, like, you should be generalist or have a minor or a second degree or some sort of capability in something else, right? Like, I think you should play a sport. Because, like, you build discipline and tenacity and high agency, and you'll see what happens when underperformers work really hard and get great at something, and you'll see what happens when superstars are lazy and they screw up their careers, right? And then you'll see all four sides of that quadrant, right? Or all four quadrants in that chart. And so, I think that agency is and hard work is going to be important, and I also think that communication is another big one. There used to be this era where, like, like, software engineers could get really, really narrow and really, really deep in an area. And I think that there'll still be places where those people will be successful. But, like, if you're just a regular new grad coming out of college, like, really go broad as you can. Does that make sense?
Sure. No, that's perfect. Yeah. So what I understand from what you said, if I wanted to summarize it, very, very summarize it, compacted, is you say, hey, computer science is still one of the best skills for problem solving. And if you wanted to be a critical thinker, problem solver, that's one of the best, skills that can help you to get there. And we need these problem solvers and thinkers, regardless of what happens.
Yeah. And I think that some of these, like, econ and finance folks, if they take a couple of computer science classes, like, that's also a valuable skill, understanding mm-hmm. what the business is actually trying to accomplish, and then, like, understanding the systems thinking behind that. But, like, it's just like you said, it's problem solving, it's systems thinking, it's communication, and it's tenacity.
Yeah, I think the only problem is that when someone comes out of a school at the very beginning, needs nurturing, needs some time to gain that confidence, to gain that experience, the expertise. And that's the toughest time now for those people really to find those careers that help them during that first some years to get there. And after they get there, then of course there are plenty of opportunities that companies need help with, but how to pass that kind of chasm in a way.
Yeah. And like, how do you, the older generation has to hand down the skills and know-how to the younger generation and give them an opportunity to be successful. And it seems pretty broken right now, doesn't it? I don't have a good, answer for that. I mean, if you take a look at, like, perhaps the leading company in this new era is Anthropic, right? The guys make Claude. They don't hire junior people for anything. And I understand why they do it. And it makes a lot of sense for why, like, why would we spend time, money, and focus training up somebody new when there's a bunch of people off the street that we can pay that will be more impactful on day one. I if I were like kind of young and coming out of school though, I wouldn't despair. I think that like, again, you know how I talked about like Opus 4.5 to me was kind of the starting gun, and it's going to take 1 to 2 years for like the economy to like figure it out and understand it. I think a big part of that is that the older generation, and I am part of it now, I guess I'm 38 years old, you know, me and all my peers, like we're all used to like talking about focus, specialization, and like we have an opinion about what a software engineer's job should be, or what a marketer's job should be, or what a financial analyst's job should be. And I think the Zoomers coming out of school, they understand the new landscape in a way that like everybody else, that the older generation doesn't. And what people are going to realize is that if you drop one of those folks into an organization with the right tools, like they're just, and it's an organization that can understand and support cutting across a bunch of different functions, those folks could be very, very impactful, because they just like, they kind of know how to like hack their way like through a lot of problems now in a way that the older generation doesn't. I will say that it's the attitudes amongst the like Gen Z that I've seen, it's a diverse generation, just like anybody else. They all have different opinions. But my one recommendation to those folks is like, really try to keep a positive sum attitude as much as you can. I know that can be hard in a tough job market. I graduated at the tail end of a recession as well, so I kind of know what it's like. But I would just say that that's the one area where like, you know, once the market figures out that this talent's actually going to be super effective and impactful, like the not having a zero sum attitude towards it is going to be the most important thing.
Now, I wanted to get back to the point that you mentioned earlier, that look at these product roadmaps. There are zillions of items there. Any company has a lot of backlog because development has not been super fast. Right. So now we are getting to the stage that these new technologies can boost our productivity. Now, developers can do more with less time with the help of AI and these new technologies. There will be just a matter of when, not if, you get to the point that now the input and output are, you know, at the same speed. Now you're adding more to the backlog and product roadmap as much as you can really do it. And then there will be time that actually you do more than what you're adding to your product roadmap, and then backlog is getting shrinking and it's getting less and less. And then at one point, as you said, you get to the point that, okay, it's not about really which company can deliver more capabilities or better product, because it seems like that's something everyone can do now. Mm-hmm. And we are at that stage. Would it be fair to say we are starting that race today, and then in a few years, really software companies in any category, the lean and mean will stay, and the other ones that were just there because they were established and they had more robust capabilities are not going to really have the same kind of weapon and the same, you know, advantage that they had before?
It's a really good question. I think that there's going to be some companies that don't adapt that will die. I think some of the business model questions in particular are the toughest ones. You know, in a in an era where like CRM is the system of record, but you only need one seat, which is an agent that like, and like we're seeing this in our Salesforce instance today, right? Like we have an agent, our Compass product sits on top of our data warehouse, which has data from all these different SaaS products. And we actually just did an analysis. The number of monthly active users of our SaaS product is roughly the same, but the usage intensity is way down. So they're logging into Salesforce, they're logging into BI, they're logging into Gong like way less often. Now that we have like a really good AI agent that's in Slack that we've built and works really well. And so when usage intensity goes down, like what does that mean for the business models of these companies? Are they going to still be able to maintain the same margins? I don't know. The other thing that you said is about startups and, you know, I think normally in a market like this, you would say, you know, the startups are going to get it. The incumbents are going to be big and slow and not going to be able to adapt. And so, lean startup, you know, disruption theory or whatever, like the incumbents get disrupted. I think that was totally true for a long time, but the new incumbents are like guys like Sam Altman and Mark Zuckerberg that like grew up reading that stuff. They did it to the last generation. And unlike the last generation of CEOs that had no idea what startups were or how they worked, like these guys do. And so I think that you see like Sam, it seems like Sam spent a bunch of money on like OpenClaw, for example. And that is a type of move that if GE invented the LLM, you know, like they wouldn't do something like that, but these new incumbents do. So it's just a long-winded way of saying like I have no idea what the future holds in this, like who's gonna win or who's gonna lose. It's just really tough right now.
Yeah, you're right. There are good and bad news for either side. If you are nimble and you're very kind of, you know, a small organization, there are some positives, but also if you already have established customer base and, you know, that kind of thing, that also counts a lot. So it's,
I also think it's helpful to look at your business like an assembly line. You know, if you think of it, if you ever read a book on industrial optimization or anything like that, where you know, you got all these different, parts that you have to bring together and assemble in certain ways. And, you really have to take a look at where's the bottleneck in my process, right? And if you think about your business, you know, like what we've got a revenue goal. What is the one bottleneck for us to hit our revenue goal? And I think for a lot of, I think the level of disruption depends on where that bottleneck is, right? That bottleneck is ability to deliver the roadmap. Like AI is going to remove that, like has already removed that bottleneck or is about to remove that bottleneck, right? That's a labor bottleneck. And that's why I'm kind of like, long software engineers for 1 to 2 years, because as the bottleneck's getting removed, like individual software engineers will be super empowered and will be really productive. But once it gets, you know, to the level of efficiency of like a combine harvester relative to somebody out in the field, like, you know, picking crops, like then it becomes labor substitution rather than complementation. Right. So if your business is bottlenecked on product, like this is great news, right? Like you're going to be crushing it. But a lot of businesses are bottlenecked on like top of funnel pipeline, right? Like can't find enough I already got a great product. I can't find enough customers and there's nothing I can build in the product that would get me more customers, right? I'm actually bottlenecked on like market attention, right? And being bottlenecked on market attention, I think in that situation, nothing changes really. It's an arms race, but at the end of the day, like you got your capital and your people and your AI and your strategy and your competition has that. And now you've got this like game, you know, game in the sense of game theory, like, you know, competing for users' attention, finding new channels, finding new messages that cut through, new pricing models that get the customer excited, et cetera. And that to me is just going to be an acceleration of what we're already doing. And that's, you know, if your business is in that category, then, you know, I think it's just going to be like less of a fundamental ground shifting beneath your feet, more just like a change in how we work.
Very good point, because as you said, if you are in the category that my challenge is engineering challenge, then maybe this situation can boost actually your situation, help you a lot, and you can boost your market. But if the challenge you have is marketing challenge, and that is a totally different situation, it's not going to be necessarily a good news at this time. And, you know, I can fix my product, but how does it help my marketing challenge? Now, I wanted to ask you a fun question that normally I ask, and that is, amongst all of the cities that you have been, all of the places that you have been, which place would you recommend me to go, for example, and travel and see that city? And you say, I loved it, Arman, you have to go. And if you have 2 weeks to really take a vacation at this particular time of the year, not now, maybe any time that you suggest, then this is the best place to go and visit, because I loved it and I was there, had a great time.
Oh, I think Barcelona is the nicest city in Europe. So that's the first, it's the first city that comes to mind for me. You know, within the US, I went to, this is like a weird one, but I went to college in Ithaca, New York, and I, basically hated living there. But during the summers, like right when you got to campus and right before you left, you know, the sun actually came out, because the sun is not out for 6 months out of the year over there. But when the sun's out, it's warm, it's nice. It's a beautiful place with some of the most beautiful waterfalls in the country. So I would actually, if you're passing through upstate New York, stopping off at Taconic Falls is well worth the trip.
Fantastic. Yeah, exactly. I haven't been there, but I have a friend that exactly told me the same thing, that this was one of the most beautiful places. And he didn't expect that. He was just driving toward Canada or some places, and then he stopped by and he said it was fantastic. I loved it. So thank you for making that suggestion. Now, at the end, I would like to ask this question. Is there any particular book that you liked it personally or professionally and you would like to recommend to others?
I read Project Hail Mary a little while ago, and I think a movie version of it is coming out this year. Project Hail Mary, I don't read a ton of fiction, but that one was highly recommended by one of my old coworkers, and it's written by Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, and it's just like kind of a cool sci-fi story, and it's one of these stories that is really, I think, grounded in realism, and is a fun story. So sometimes sci-fi can get like a little heavy-handed, and this one is the appropriate amount of heavy-handedness, I think. And it's also got great character development. And so, you know, anytime you get a good sci-fi story with like three-dimensional characters and that's fun to read, I'm into it. So I would say Project Hail Mary would be one worth reading before the movie comes out.
Perfect. It was great having you here, Pete. Thank you for joining us. Great discussion. And we will hopefully, you know, we can catch up maybe in a year or two and then see what we said today. You know, how did it play?
Cool. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Arman Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to sasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.